Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for May 20th, 2022. I'm your reader, Stephen Gager. Ag and Environment. Farmers plant nearly half of Iowa's corn in past week. By Jared Strong, May 16th, 2022. A hot and dry week finally gave Iowa farmers their best chance yet to plant corn this year, and they put about 43% of the crop seed in the ground in that time, according to U.S. Department of Agriculture report on Monday. Corn planting was about 2 weeks behind the five-year average a week ago. Now it's about 9 days behind. Some farmers have been working day and night. Quote, they're really pushing hard to get done. Angie Rieck-Heinz, a field agronomist for Iowa State University Extension and Outreach, who monitors 8 counties in north central Iowa. Quote, we've made a substantial improvement in planting progress this last week. That region of the state made the biggest gains, going from 7% of the corn planted last week to 68% this week. Statewide, that percentage jumped from 14% last week to 57% this week. Weather improves at pivotal time. This is a crucial time for corn farmers. Yield potentials begin to diminish when planting occurs after the middle of May and fall off precipitously in June, according to ISU research. Planting had been delayed for weeks by cold and wet weather. The wet soil can be difficult for tractors to navigate, and the cold diminished the likelihood that the seed would sprout quickly. Corn seed needs soil temperatures of about 50 degrees to germinate. That trend reversed last week when, quote, anomalously hot conditions blanketed much of the central United States, state climatologist Justin Gleason said in his weekly weather report. The state's temperatures averaged 13 degrees above normal, with high temperatures that reached into the 80s and 90s. Typical highs this time of year are in the low 70s, according to the National Weather Service. Those higher temperatures pushed average soil temperatures into the 60s, recent ISU data show. Scattered thunderstorms throughout the week were minimally disruptive to farmers, who had a total of about 5.2 days that were suitable for fieldwork, the USDA report said. A storm with strong, straight-line winds of up to 80 miles per hour struck the far northwest corner of the state on Thursday and damaged the roofs of several livestock facilities, said Joel DeJong, an ISU Extension field agronomist in that area. But it did not significantly impact planting. Quote, we're making really good progress, he said. By the end of the week, we're going to have a vast majority of the crop in the ground in northwest Iowa. Iowa farmers plant about 13 million acres of corn each year, and they can plant at a pace of more than 1 million acres per day when the conditions are right, said Mark Licht, an ISU Extension and Cropping Systems specialist. Soybean planting also accelerated in the past week, the USDA report said. About a third of the soybean crop was in the ground as of Sunday, up from 7% the week before. The work is about a week behind the five-year average. Quote, as we look ahead, weather outlooks show promise in keeping planters rolling and farmers busy in the field, Mike Naig, the state's Secretary of Agriculture, said in a press release about the progress. Ag and Environment, Government and Politics. New ethanol law could spark regional trend, biofuels exec says. By Jared Strong, May 17, 2022. A new state law that requires most of Iowa's fuel stations to sell a gasoline blend with 15% ethanol will rapidly expand the fuel's availability. But the law's long-term effects might be more potent, according to the executive director of the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association. Governor Kim Reynolds signed House File 2128, aimed at boosting the use of corn-based ethanol to fuel the state's vehicles, into law on Tuesday. Her action capped a protracted and hard-fought legislative initiative that began last year. The 2021 proposal would have required nearly all gasoline pumps to dispense fuels blended with ethanol, similar to Minnesota's requirements, but it failed to generate enough support for passage. This year's compromise bill requires at least half of gasoline pumps to dispense E15, but has exceptions for smaller fueling stations and others with outdated tanks that would be too expensive to replace. It underwent several revisions this session before the Iowa House and Senate each approved it in late April. The new law is also expected to boost the sales of diesel blends that contain 20% biodiesel, which is often made with soybean oil. Quote, this is an exciting day for Iowa as we sign truly a landmark biofuels bill into law, Reynolds said Tuesday on a farm near Prairie City, east of Des Moines. Monty Shaw, the Iowa Renewable Fuels Association's executive director, predicts that E15 will be available at 1,000 more stations in 2026, when the ethanol requirement goes into effect. That would more than quadruple the current total, according to state data. Shaw estimates the new requirements will lead to an increased demand for ethanol of about 60 million gallons per year. That's not a huge increase compared to the state's production capacity of more than 4 billion gallons per year, but the new law sets the stage for future expansion on two fronts, Shaw said. Quote, I honestly believe that we'll look back on this and say that this was the most important piece of biofuels legislation Iowa has ever enacted, he said. First, the law also requires new fuel station infrastructure, the tanks, fuel lines, and pumps, to be compatible with higher blends of ethanol, which can degrade certain plastics and rubbers. That will help facilitate future increases in blend requirements, perhaps with gasoline blends of 30 or 40% ethanol, Shaw said. Incompatible equipment was a primary roadblock for the current legislation, with some small-town fuel stations warning that earlier drafts of the bill had requirements that would have put them out of business. The final version exempted gas stations that sell fewer than 300,000 gallons per year. Quote, we really wanted to be conscientious of the small retailers in rural Iowa, Reynolds told reporters after the bill signing event. I was not going to be a governor that shut down a gas station in rural Iowa. Second, Shaw said Iowa will be an example to other states that could adopt similar ethanol requirements. Quote, Iowa is the tip of the spear, he said. We can show that consumers will respond to it in Iowa. But then we want to export these policies. Let's face it, there's a lot of states that burn more fuel than Iowa. He specifically mentioned Nebraska and Minnesota to potentially consider higher ethanol blend requirements. But standing in the way of further E15 expansion are federal rules that prohibit the summer sales of certain E15 blends because federal regulators have considered them more likely to evaporate in warmer temperatures and pollute the air. The Biden administration lifted that restriction, which affects about two-thirds of the country, for this summer to help reduce fuel prices. Advocates for ethanol say the fuel's reduced tailpipe emissions compared with gasoline more than compensate for the evaporation pollution. But a recent study found that ethanol is worse for the environment than gasoline when emissions from growing corn and processing it into ethanol are taken into account. Reynolds and other Midwestern governors have lobbied federal lawmakers to allow year-round E15 sales permanently. Shaw said he was confident those efforts will be successful, but oil companies have long opposed such a move. Further, the Biden administration has put great emphasis on switching to electric vehicles. The demand for ethanol has large implications for Iowa farmers. About half of their corn is used to produce the fuel. Quote, ethanol means a lot to me because, as a young farmer, I didn't grow up on a farm where we farmed full-time, said Will Cannon, a Jasper County farmer who introduced Reynolds on Tuesday. It's taken a lot of hard work and persistence to be able to farm full-time, but it's also taken markets and opportunities for good prices. And ethanol is one of those markets that helps to get good prices so someone like me has an opportunity to farm. Gordon Wassenaar, owner of the farm outside Prairie City where the bill was signed, quipped that, quote, oil is too valuable to blow it out your tailpipe, end quote. He said oil can be used for many things besides fuel, and once it's burned, it's gone. Quote, and here with ethanol, you can turn around and grow another crop of corn, Wassenaar said. Editor Kathy Obradovich contributed to this article. Education, justice. Human trafficking lawsuit against Iowa College survives legal challenge. By Clark Kaufman, May 17, 2022. A human trafficking lawsuit brought by 14 international students from Chile against Western Iowa Tech Community College has survived a round of legal challenges and is proceeding in federal court. The school and other defendants are accused of working in concert to entice impoverished students to leave their home in Chile and come to Iowa, where they were placed in, quote, debt bondage, end quote, working at a food processing plant and dog food factory. The Sioux City College allegedly procured visas for the Chilean students to enroll in the school's international education program, then steered them to work in the processing plants. The college diverted money from students' paychecks to reimburse the school for the cost of the program, the lawsuit claims. The defendants in the case, all of whom have denied any wrongdoing, include the college, several of its employees, Turpac Foods, which runs a food processing plant in Sioux City, Royal Canin USA, which runs a dog food factory in North Sioux City, South Dakota, and J&L Staffing and Recruiting, which allegedly helped place the students in the two plants at the behest of the school. The lawsuit, filed in November 2020, recently survived a broad array of legal challenges mounted by the defendants. Chief Judge of the U.S. District Court for the Northern District of Iowa, Leonard T. Strand, dismissed claims of racketeering and indentured servitude against the defendant, but let stand several counts alleging human trafficking, breach of contract, fraud, and, with regard to the school, the intentional infliction of emotional distress. Quote, WITCC specifically prohibited the students from seeking other employment without permission, making their labor for TURPAC or Royal Canin the only way they could provide for themselves, Strand stated in his ruling. The students are foreign nationals with varying levels of proficiency in English. They all made financial sacrifices to be part of the program, with several of them selling nearly everything they owned prior to enrolling in the program. Thus, they had no obvious alternatives. The students in the case allege they participated in the federal J-1B program for college students, which gives foreign students the opportunity to participate in a visitor exchange program while studying at a post-secondary accredited school in the United States. Generally, exchange students in the J-1 program can take jobs if their employment is related to their schooling or is on campus. In early 2019, the lawsuit alleges, the U.S. Department of State approved WITCC's application to host exchange students as part of the J-1 visa program. Around that time, school officials allegedly began negotiations with J&L Staffing and Recruiting to find a way to fund the program. The lawsuit alleges that WITCC agreed to bring the students to the United States and J&L agreed to place the students at TURPAC and Royal Canin. The details of the agreement allegedly provided that the school would secure the visas for the students and house them on campus, while J&L would provide transportation between WITCC's student housing complex and the plants. The arrangement called for Royal Canin and TURPAC to pay $15 an hour for the students' labor, but $7.75 an hour would go to the college to offset the expense of the students' housing, tuition, and fees, the lawsuit claims. The students would then be left with the minimum wage of $7.25 an hour. J&L would allegedly collect fees from the plant for providing workers and would also collect fees from students for transportation and employment vouchers. According to the lawsuit, the school then entered into an agreement with four Chileans to recruit students in that country, and by March 2019, 25 students were successfully recruited. Lawsuit. College promised free tuition, room, and board. In April 2019, school officials, along with representatives of J&L, traveled from Iowa to Chile to meet with recruiters there and the prospective students. The Iowa group allegedly told the students they would be able to earn a two-year degree in either a culinary arts or robotics program and would also be enrolled in an, quote, internship experience, end quote, that would improve their chances of furthering their careers with room, board, and tuition provided. Those promises were allegedly put in writing in the form of an, quote, open letter, end quote, from the school to its, quote, Brazilian Chilean friends, end quote. The letter allegedly told students they would be required to work as many as 35 hours per week while attending class for 12 hours per week. But the work was reportedly billed as an internship program with scholarships, not as manual labor in processing plants. In late April, the school sent prospective student letters of acceptance into the program along with a, quote, job offer letter, end quote, to work for J&L. It did not describe the nature or location of the work or the rate of pay, but it allegedly did describe it as a, quote, valuable resume-enhancing experience for candidates to gain work experience, end quote. In June 2019, the school allegedly sent an email to the students and Chilean recruiters indicating that while J&L would still assist in placing students in jobs as an employment agency, J&L was barred from acting as a partner in the program. According to the lawsuit, the email also stated that at no time were the participants to mention that the reason for their internship was, quote, the lack of workers in the area, even when indeed there is a need for workers. Also, we cannot call you workers, but student interns, and we cannot use the word salary or wages, but stipends or compensation, end quote. The lawsuit alleges the changes were made to hide from the State Department the fact that the planned, quote, internship program, end quote, amounted to off-campus work in processing plants and thus violated the rules for the J-1 visa program. Culinary arts, rebranded as processing plant work. The students' final letters of acceptance into the program stated the students were, quote, not responsible for the cost of your tuition, fees, housing, or supplies, end quote, and added that quote, meals will be provided at the college, the lawsuit claims. With regard to the work, the letter allegedly stated, quote, you will have your training in an external environment provided by industries/partners that are served by our corporate college, a division of the Western Iowa Tech Community College. These companies send their employees to our corporate college to acquire knowledge and training when and if it is necessary, and they are willing to participate in this cultural interchange by allowing us to use their facilities and plants, end quote. At the same time, the, quote, culinary arts, end quote, program students signed up for was rebranded as a, quote, food service diploma program, end quote, that would prepare students for jobs, quote, directly related to automated food production industries for humans or pets consumption, end quote. Also, the, quote, robotics program, end quote, students signed up for was rebranded as the, quote, electromechanical technician program, end quote, which would provide training for, quote, an entry-level position, end quote, as an industrial mechanic in automated food production industries. School officials then certified to the State Department that the student's work would entail, quote, shadowing in three different environments, the local cafeteria at college, and two business partners consisting in a hotel restaurant and a food preparation industry just to observe, ellipses, job shadowing will take place at our corporate college partners, end quote. The school, the lawsuit alleges, quote, knew this was not an accurate description of the work that the plaintiffs would be performing, end quote, and knew the students would simply be, quote, working on a production line, filling a labor shortage in the Siouxland area, end quote. Students complain of 12-hour overnight shifts. Once the students arrived at WITCC from Chile, the lawsuit claims, they were not offered free tuition or free room and board, and were instead routed to Turpak Processing Plant and to Royal Canin's Dog Food Factory. In those plants, the lawsuit alleges, the students were, quote, required to work as line workers in positions that required no skills at all and were not related to the plaintiff's field of study, end quote. Some of the students had to work 12-hour overnight shifts and then report to class by 8 a.m., the lawsuit claims. Prior to the students receiving their paychecks, withdrawals were made for employee badges, transportation, and for taxes that normally are not charged to students on J-1 visas, the lawsuit alleges. Other withdrawals were allegedly made but not recorded on the students' pay stubs, such as the $7.75 an hour that allegedly went to WITCC as payment for tuition, fees, room, and board. During the week before their employment started, the students were allegedly given Walmart or Hy-Vee gift cards for food. Once they began working, the school allegedly stopped providing the cards. When students complained that the long hours in the plant made it impossible for them to attend class and that the work didn't amount to any sort of educational internship, WITCC allegedly threatened the students with deportation and withheld food from the students. In November 2019, the State Department allegedly began an investigation of the matter and informed the school the jobs at Turpak and Royal Canin were not, quote, internships, end quote, and the students were in violation of their J-1 visa status. The lawsuit claimed WITCC then told the students they'd have to quit their jobs and that they would owe the college $250 a week for room, board, tuition, and fees. After the students complained publicly of their treatment, the school allegedly tried to placate them with access to WITCC's food pantry and by taking them to local churches so they could solicit donations. Only later did the school agree to provide the students with two meals per day in the school cafeteria, along with a Hy-Vee gift card to cover other food expenses. In March 2020, WITCC, still under investigation by the State Department, canceled the student visas, citing the COVID-19 pandemic, and paid for the students to return home to Chile. At the time, the school allegedly allowed its other international students who were in the United States on a different type of visa to remain in Sioux City while attending classes virtually. Although the federal lawsuit is 18 months old, a trial date has not yet been scheduled. The plaintiffs have amended their complaint twice, and the school and other defendants only recently filed a response to that set of allegations. The plaintiffs in the case are Chilean citizens Carla O'Neill Narambuena, Natalia Tapia Levia, Almendra Gonzalez de la Paz, David Silva Moreno, Fernando Vilches Castillo, Claudia Ramos, Alejandro Pizarro, Eduardo Antonio Muñoz Vargas, Carolyn Sarai Camas Jorquera, Gonzalo Escobar Espello, Catalina Nomue Rivas Morales, Beren Mora Guerrera, Diego Cristobal Ahumada Solandra, and Nestor Acevedo. Education, government, and politics. Lawmakers resume public consideration of state budget. Governor says discussions continue about private school scholarships. By Kathy Obradovich. May 17, 2022. Iowa lawmakers will resume public discussion on the state budget Wednesday, just over 4 weeks past the 100th day of the 2022 session. The Senate Appropriations Committee is scheduled to meet Wednesday morning and begin preparing budget bills for the floor debate. For the past several weeks, discussion has been behind closed doors as legislative leaders negotiated with each other and with the governor. Senate Majority Leader Jack Whitfer, Republican Ankeny, said some of the bills may have agreement with the House and others don't, but he didn't specify which ones. Quote, I've been meeting with the Speaker and the Governor over the last few days and progressing through conversation. So hopefully, in the next couple of weeks, we can come to some kind of agreement and really get moving on session, Whitfer, Republican Ankeny, told reporters Tuesday. He said he hopes to establish joint budget targets with the House. He downplayed the $70 million difference between the House and Senate spending proposals. Quote, I mean, the big difference is $70 million, but when you start moving around different pieces and figuring out apples to apples, and you know, what's in the general fund and what's in other funds, it's really not that far apart. Reynolds, talks continue on private school scholarships. The House passed 9 budget bills through the chamber last month, but the Senate did not advance them in part because of a standoff over private school scholarships. Governor Kim Reynolds proposed the legislation, which was approved by the Senate March 30th. House Republicans, however, did not have enough votes to approve the measure, which would scoop state aid from private schools to pay expenses for students who move to private schools. Reynolds said Tuesday she wasn't giving up on the proposal for this year until lawmakers adjourn and, quote, go home, end quote. She said she's continuing to explore changes to the proposal, including narrowing the bill by limiting the number of students or the number of schools affected. Quote, so, I've been very open and vocal that I'm willing to sit down with any legislator and walk through, you know, some different ideas that they may have. And actually, they've come with quite a few, she said. She was also firm on the need to include parents' rights and transparency provisions, which were included in the Senate bill. Quote, I think ultimately what we need to do is make sure that parents have a say in their child's education. And I just fundamentally disagree with school districts icing parents out of educational decisions, she said. Reynolds referred to recent debate over new inclusive transgender policies enacted by the Lynmar School District in Marion. The policy, which district officials said was based on federal guidelines, allows transgender students to use their preferred name, pronouns, and facilities matching their gender identity. Students in 7th grade or higher could override their parents' preferences or choose not to inform them. Quote, I just don't think that a 7th grader should be deciding what their parent knows and doesn't know. It's ridiculous, Reynolds said. Whitfer said negotiations on the issue have been between Reynolds and House Speaker Pat Grassley, and he declined further comment. Grassley refused to take questions from reporters Tuesday. Whitfer said other policy issues also remain to be decided, although he didn't name specific bills. Quote, when we come back, it will be more than just budget, he said. There's still, you know, a lot of bills alive on my desk. There's still some left on Grassley's. But I really want to work with the House and figure out which of those bills are priorities for them, and then, you know, do the same for the bills that we have over there. Lawmakers need to pass a budget by June 30th to avoid a government shutdown. Reynolds remained confident that would not be an issue. Quote, we're not going to shut the state down, she said. We're not Washington, D.C., and we're never going to be. So we know how to sit down, work together, have a conversation, and move things forward. Government and politics. Capital Clicks. Governor signs Mobile Home Protections Bill. By Jared Strong, May 17, 2022. Mobile home park tenants will get an additional month's notice before evictions or increases to the rent and utility fees under a new state law that was signed Tuesday by Governor Kim Reynolds. House File 2562, which got final approval from state legislators in April, also creates protections for tenants of parks that do not provide essential services such as running water. The law is a response to the requests of tenants who for years have sought more legal protections against rent increases and evictions as out-of-state, private equity firms have purchased the parks and, in some cases, doubled or tripled rent and utility costs with little notice. The new law increases the notification requirements from 60 days to 90. Lobbyists for mobile home park landlords have opposed legislation that would erode their power. Democrats in the Iowa Senate voted against the bill along party lines because it did not adequately address tenants' concerns. Ag and environment, education, governments and politics, healthcare. State budget stalemate ends as 10 budget bills advance. Democrats protest shortcuts in budget planning. By Kate Keeley, May 18, 2022. An Iowa Senate panel, in a day-long session, advanced 10 budget bills Wednesday after weeks of behind-the-scenes negotiations among GOP legislative leaders and the governor. Governor Kim Reynolds and House Republicans had proposed to spend about $8.2 billion from the state general fund for the 2023 fiscal year, which begins July 1, 2022. The House passed 9 budget bills last month, which had been awaiting Senate action. Republican senators proposed to spend about $70 million less, and negotiations have been stalled over policy differences between the chambers. Republicans on the Senate Appropriations Committee said Wednesday they had reached agreement with the House on most of the bills, which were amended in committee. Both chambers are expected to be back in the Capitol next week to start working toward adjournment, more than 4 weeks after a 100-day session was scheduled to end. Lawmakers still debating money for Glenwood transition. Some budget issues remained unresolved Wednesday. For example, Senator Joe Bulcombe, Democrat, Iowa City, asked how the state would pay for community-based services needed to house residents of the Glenwood Resource Center, which is scheduled to close in 2024. The state-run facility for people with disabilities has operated under a shadow after a Department of Justice investigation in 2019 and 2020 found that staff at the center failed to provide adequate medical care and abused and performed experiments on residents. Some residents will move to the Woodward Resource Center, but others are expected to find, quote, community placements, end quote, under the plan announced by the Department of Human Services. Quote, so there is going to be a transition cost here, and community providers will need to be built up and strengthened. And so I believe there will be money in there for that, a substantial amount, one way or another, Senator Mark Costello, Republican Imogene, said. He said lawmakers were still working out whether the money would come from the general fund or federal dollars the government can access. Bulcombe said he recognizes that Reynolds still has access to millions in federal American Rescue Plan dollars, but cautioned that money will run out in a couple years. Quote, so I think, ellipses, the committee is setting itself up, I think, for a pretty substantial cliff in 2 years by saying, subquote, well, we're not going to fund it this year, we'll let the governor fund it, end subquote. And at some point, the cows are going to come home. Education budget still unresolved. Republican lawmakers said they were also still negotiating the nearly $1 billion education budget. One of the major disagreements between the House and Senate is over the governor's proposed private school scholarships. The panel forwarded the House bill on a party-line vote without amendments, with changes expected on the floor. The House approved a flat budget for the state universities for the third year in a row. Instead, the House introduced a $12 million scholarship fund to be split between teacher training and students pursuing high-demand jobs. Quote, we have been starving colleges and universities for at least a decade, and there is no increased funding for Iowa public universities in this budget, said Senator Jackie Smith, Democrat, Sioux City. As we all realize that state support goes down, tuition goes up. So we are shifting the financial burden to Iowa students and families, and I think that is the wrong way. Senator Chris Coynoyer, Republican LeClaire, said there are programs that support all students to pursue a post-secondary education, such as the Future Ready Iowa program and student loan repayment programs. Coynoyer said these programs also create incentives for people to move to Iowa and reside in the state. Quote, the data shows that those programs are working especially at getting high-need occupations into those rural areas, so I am going to continue to advocate for that, Coynoyer said. Senate bill trims environmental budgets. One of the bills that House and Senate Republicans have agreed upon will fund agriculture and natural resource programs. The committee, voting along party lines, approved House File 2560, a $42 million budget. That's a cut of about $6 million cut over the current year and about $12 million less than the House approved this year. Senator Claire Selce, Democrat, West Des Moines, said the Department of Natural Resources is already underfunded and the state is facing severe water quality problems. Quote, we have absolutely no plan to protect our state agriculture system and our water and everyone from climate change, Selce said. I know we never talk about that here, but I really just want to say that we are going to be caught unprepared We are unprepared for what is coming, for what is already here. Senator Ken Rosenboom, Republican of Oskaloosa, served as the floor manager of the bill. He said the arguments by the minority party aren't anything new, and there are hundreds of millions of dollars already allocated to those programs at the federal level. Democrats protest lack of public discussion. Democrats on the Senate Appropriations Committee voted against most of the bills, which some said were developed without enough deliberation or public input. The Senate did not hold joint appropriations subcommittee meetings with the House. Quote, "Yeah, I've been here 20 years, and this is probably the least amount of meetings we've ever had," end quote. Except during the pandemic last year, Representative Amanda Reagan, Democrat, Mason City, said. Costello acknowledged that, quote, "There's a certain amount that we miss," end quote, by not holding joint budget meetings with the House. But he said, quote, "On the other hand, we can get more discussed quickly, more quickly, with fewer people." Editor Kathy Obradovich contributed to this report. You are listening to the reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for May 20th, 2022, on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind. Now let's continue with this week's stories. COVID-19, healthcare. CDC warns of rising COVID risk in Iowa. By Jared Strong, May 18th, 2022. For the first time in 2 months, an Iowa county has a high level of community risk for COVID-19, according to the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Poweshiek County has that distinction due to a combination of its infection and hospitalization rates that the CDC uses to characterize the threat of infection. It recommends people wear masks indoors in public places when the threat is high. Eight other counties have the designation of medium risk, mostly in northern Iowa: Allemachie, Chickasaw, Clay, Dickinson, Floyd, Howard, Johnson, and Palo Alto. An update on those threat assessments is expected Thursday. The state's rate of infection has been on the rise since late March, and there were an average of about 550 new confirmed coronavirus cases each day in the past week, according to the data released Wednesday by the Iowa Department of Public Health. That infection rate is about 10% of the pandemic peak in January, but it is 7 times higher than the lull in late March. It's unclear how many new infections are uncounted because people are using free and widely available at-home tests that aren't tracked by the state. IDPH reported on Wednesday a total of 3,847 new cases for the past week and 18 new deaths, although it's unclear when those deaths happened. Hospitalizations continue to rise. There were 145 people infected by the coronavirus receiving inpatient treatment at Iowa hospitals on Wednesday, a 17% increase from the previous week. Of those, 19 were under intensive care, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. COVID-19, healthcare, working, and economy. Federal law mandates Iowans firing, while state law provides jobless benefits. By Clark Kaufman, May 18, 2022. Two Iowa healthcare workers fired for violating a federal law requiring them to be vaccinated against COVID-19 have been awarded jobless benefits due to a state law that ensures such workers can still collect unemployment. In one case, a judge noted that while the worker could have kept her job by simply claiming a medical or religious exemption, doing so would have forced her to be untruthful. State records indicate that Jacqueline Eggert worked for Visiting Nurses Association of Johnson County as a certified nurse aide and home care aide, visiting patients in their homes to provide caregiving. In 2021, she was notified by her employer that federal laws required the agency's employees to either be vaccinated against COVID-19 virus or have an exemption from vaccination. The only exemptions allowed, according to the federal law at that time, were for medical or religious reasons. Eggert declined to get a vaccination due to her own personal belief that the vaccine was developed too quickly and without adequate research. On February 11th, the deadline for compliance, she turned in her work materials and quit due to the lack of vaccination. Citing the new Iowa law that prohibits the state from denying unemployment benefits to workers who lost their jobs for refusing the vaccine, Administrative Law Judge Don Boucher ruled recently that Eggert was eligible for benefits. Quote, "It is clear that Eggert was discharged from employment for refusing to receive a vaccination against COVID-19," Boucher wrote in her ruling. "It is also clear that both parties in this case were put between a rock and a hard spot," end quote. The employer was required by federal law to have all employees vaccinated or secured exemptions on file. The law only allowed her employer to use medical or religious exemptions. Eggert was uncomfortable completing either exemption request as they did not comport with the reasons for her refusal of the COVID-19 vaccination. She should not be required to be untruthful in completing an exemption request, end quote. Another Iowa worker, Taylor Vasquez, was recently awarded unemployment benefits under similar circumstances. Vasquez worked for Crothall Healthcare as a full-time nutrition operator from May 2017 until her termination in February of this year. In January, citing a federal mandate for its workers to be vaccinated, Crothall told employees that they must receive their vaccine or apply for a medical or religious exemption by February 14th, or they'd be fired. Vasquez opted to forego the vaccine without applying for an exemption. Despite the federal law that mandated her dismissal, Vasquez was awarded unemployment benefits due to the state law on job losses caused by vaccine refusals. More Iowa unemployment decisions. Other Iowans whose unemployment claims were recently decided by an administrative law judge or the State Employment Appeal Board include Michael Gass, who worked for the Iowa Correctional Institute for Women as a full-time correctional officer for 25 years until September of last year. He was fired for violating a policy that says prisoner transportation runs can include a bathroom break only if they are taken at law enforcement centers or correctional facilities. While transporting two offenders to the University of Iowa hospitals last August, Gass contacted the shift's supervisor and reported an urgent need to make a bathroom stop. The supervisor directed him to the nearest law enforcement center, which was 25 to 30 miles away, but stated that if it was an emergency, he could use the nearest rest area. A few minutes later, Gass pulled off the road and, while keeping the transport vehicle in sight, relieved himself in a nearby ditch. After returning to the correctional facility, he informed his supervisor of his actions, which led to a formal investigation and his termination. An administrative law judge later denied Gass's application for unemployment benefits, ruling that he had shown, quote, a willful disregard, end quote, for the employer's standards of behavior. Gass appealed that decision to the state's Employment Appeal Board, which recently reversed the judge's decision, stating that Gass's only alternative to pulling over would have meant, quote, creating a medical issue for himself and or producing what may be considered hazardous material on board the employer's vehicle. Gass's behavior, the board said, was, quote, an isolated incident that didn't give rise to the legal definition of misconduct. Julie Minui, who was employed by Waterloo's Allen Memorial Hospital as a patient safety companion from September 2020 through February of this year. Minui was fired for misconduct after a co-worker allegedly caught her in the employee locker room digging through that same co-worker's purse. Minui had allegedly taken some of the co-worker's prescription medication. Minui later admitted to stealing the drugs, according to a judge's finding, and was terminated. She was denied unemployment benefits. Election 2022. Government and Politics. Capital Clicks. Early voting begins for Iowa primaries. By Jared Strong, May 18, 2022. Absentee voting for Iowa's June 7 primary elections started Wednesday, and residents who wish to vote by mail must get those requests to their county auditors by Monday. The early voting timeframe has been shortened from 40 to 20 days prior to elections by successive state legislation in the past 5 years. Also, mailed ballots must now arrive at auditors' offices by the close of polls at 8 p.m. on Election Day to be counted under normal circumstances. Auditors began mailing requested ballots to voters on Wednesday. Residents can cast their early ballots in person at the auditors' offices until the day before the election during their normal office hours. Those hours and contact information for the offices are listed here. Those who wish to vote on Election Day can do so between 7 a.m. and 8 p.m. at their designated polling sites. Voters can find their sites here. Voter pre-registration for the primaries ends Monday. Otherwise, residents can register on Election Day. D.C. Bureau, Governments and Politics, Healthcare. Congress, White House, scramble to ease baby formula shortage. By Jennifer Schutt and Jacob Fischler, May 19, 2022. Washington. Both the Biden administration and Congress moved Wednesday to try to relieve a national infant formula shortage as the White House invoked the Defense Production Act and the U.S. House approved $28 million for the Food and Drug Administration. President Joe Biden said he would use the law to address the formula shortage, requiring suppliers to fill orders from formula manufacturers before other customers. Biden also directed Health and Human Services Secretary Xavier Becerra and Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack to use Defense Department planes to more quickly import formula from overseas that meets U.S. health and safety standards. Quote, Imports of baby formula will serve as a bridge to this ramped-up production. Therefore, I am requesting you all take appropriate measures available to get additional safe formula into the country immediately, Biden wrote to the secretaries. Meanwhile, the House voted mostly along party lines late Wednesday to approve the FDA funding, but Republicans overwhelmingly opposed it, saying that it would provide a blank check to the FDA and that doesn't take steps to actually get infant formula back on store shelves quickly. The measure is unlikely to get past the U.S. Senate's legislative filibuster without GOP backing, meaning lawmakers in that chamber will either have to amend the bill or start from scratch on their own legislation. The final House vote was 231 to 192. All Democrats and 12 Republicans voted in favor. Iowa's delegation voted along party lines, with Democratic Representative Cindy Axne in favor and Republican Representatives Randy Feenstra, Ashley Hinson, and Marionette Miller-Meeks voting no. Quote, the emergency funds allocated by this bill will help safely expedite the inspection of the country's infant formula supply and quickly get it back on the shelves of stores across the country, said U.S. Representative Sanford Bishop Jr., a Georgia Democrat who chairs the House spending panel that oversees FDA funding. Bishop said Congress should also investigate how the problem occurred in the first place. But Maryland's Andy Harris, the acting top Republican on that spending panel, said the Biden administration should have gotten ahead of the problem when shortages started last fall. He said Democrats' approach amounted to, quote, throwing money at the problem, end quote, after it became a crisis. Quote, this is not a money problem, he said. This is a leadership problem. House Energy and Commerce Chairman Frank Pallone, a New Jersey Democrat, responded that when his committee had tried to create a funding mechanism for food safety, Republicans had blocked it. Quote, if that money had been in place, we would have had the inspectors, he said. We would have had the ability, in my opinion, to do a lot more on the issue of food safety. The bill, which U.S. House Democrats released Tuesday, would give the FDA an additional $28 million to address the current infant formula shortage, prevent future shortages, and stop fraudulent products from entering the country. About half the formula sold nationwide is bought by families using benefits under the Special Supplemental Nutrition Program for Women, Infants, and Children, which is administered by the USDA. In his own press release, Vilsack said that he understood the shortage was, quote, causing stress and anxiety for many families, end quote, and pledged to undertake the actions Biden had called for under the Defense Production Act, which gives emergency authorities to the chief executive. Quote, as the president directed, the Department of Agriculture will immediately begin coordinating with the Department of Defense and expand its coordination with our Health and Human Services counterparts to get safe formula on store shelves as quickly as possible, he said. The supplemental funding bill the House passed Wednesday was meant to work in tandem with Biden's actions, the bill's sponsor, Connecticut Democrat Rosa DeLauro, said during a floor debate. Abbott closure. The current shortage began in mid-February when Abbott Laboratories had to close its Sturgis, Michigan plant after four babies became sick and at least two died. In the 4 months since, other plants have struggled to keep up with demand as store shelves have increasingly emptied. That Abbott manufacturing facility will be allowed to reopen soon under a consent decree with the U.S. Justice Department that will require the company to take several steps to address safety at the facility. The plant's managers will need to hire, quote, outside expert assistance, end quote, to ensure they comply with federal law and good manufacturing practice regulations. The Justice Department also filed a complaint in federal court in the Western District of Michigan as part of the agreement that alleges Abbott, quote, manufactured powdered infant formula under conditions and using practices that failed to comply with regulations designed to ensure the quality and safety of infant formula, including protection against the risk of contamination from bacteria such as Cronobacter Sakazaki. Abbott said in a statement that it would need about 2 weeks to restart the facility. After that, it would take 6 to 8 weeks before products would begin appearing on store shelves. The company plans to begin production of Alimentum, Elicare, and Metabolic formulas before restarting production of Similac and other formulas. Abbott President of U.S. and Canada Nutrition and Senior Vice President Christopher J. Calamari will testify about the shortage in front of the U.S. House Energy and Commerce Committee on May 25th. Pallone and Oversight and Investigation Subcommittee Chair Diana DeGetta, a Colorado Democrat, said when announcing the hearing that, quote, it is unconscionable that families are struggling to find safe and affordable infant formula, end quote. FDA Commissioner Robert M. Califf is scheduled to testify at that hearing as well as one Thursday in front of the U.S. House panel that drafted the $28 million bill and controls the agency's funding levels. The chair of that panel, DeLauro, released a whistleblower report from an employee at the factory that alleges Abbott officials falsified records, released untested infant formula, and hid information during a 2019 FDA audit. The Connecticut Democrat said at the time that she was concerned the FDA, quote, reacted far too slowly to this report, end quote. Quote, the report was submitted to the FDA on October 20th, 2021. The FDA did not interview the whistleblower until late December 2021. According to news reports, FDA did not inspect the plant in person until January 31st, 2022, and the recall was not issued until February 17th, 2022. D.C. Bureau, Government and Politics, Healthcare, Justice. U.S. House Judiciary Committee debates abortion in advance of landmark court ruling. By Jennifer Schutt, May 18th, 2022. Washington. The national debate over abortion rights raged in the U.S. House Judiciary Committee on Wednesday, as Democrats warned of the dangers of a potential end to the constitutional right, and Republicans argued that legislature should determine abortion laws. The hearing came just weeks after a leaked draft opinion from Associate Justice Samuel Alito showed the U.S. Supreme Court's conservative justices poised to end the fundamental right to terminate a pregnancy that was established in 1973 and reaffirmed in 1992. Democrats said the hearing was essential to informing Americans how their lives would change if the court overturns Roe v. Wade. Republicans on the panel rebuked their colleagues for holding a hearing they contended was meant to influence the Supreme Court ahead of its final decision, expected in late June. Georgia Democrat Representative Hank Johnson pointed to the lack of health care providers for people throughout his home state, saying that half of Georgia counties don't have an obstetrician gynecologist, or a family physician. Johnson said that has made Georgia, quote, the most dangerous state in the nation for pregnant women, end quote. He also expressed frustration with Georgia state lawmakers passing legislation that would bar most abortions after 6 weeks of pregnancy, but not bolstering health care services for those people. Quote, isn't it ironic that states like Georgia want to force women to remain pregnant, but seem unwilling to help women stay alive during pregnancy, Johnson said. Maternal deaths among black women. Michelle Goodwin, Chancellor's Professor of Law at the University of California, Irvine, testified that many states moving to enact strict limits on abortion access are the same states with the highest rates of maternal mortality. Goodwin said those higher maternal mortality rates have had a disproportionate effect on women of color. Quote, there has been so little attention to the fact black women have suffered in grave and inhumane ways in states with abortion bans, Goodwin testified. Many Republican-controlled state legislatures have been rushing to tighten their abortion laws as the date of the court ruling nears. They are some of the strictest limits on abortion enacted in decades. Dr. Yashika Robinson, medical director at Alabama Women's Healthcare Center and an at-large member on the board of directors for Physicians for Reproductive Health, testified that black women in Alabama are 5 times more likely to die from pregnancy than white women. Robinson told the committee that systemic barriers, racism, and white supremacy are at the root of the maternal health care crisis. Quote, restrictions on abortions affect everyone, yet fall hardest on those who are marginalized, Robinson said. Republicans slam Roe. Republicans on the panel contended the hearing seemed intended to sway the Supreme Court justices' decision-making process as the 9 justices continue working toward releasing a decision on the case in Mississippi's 15-week abortion law, Dobbs v. Jackson Women's Health Organization. GOP lawmakers also said the Supreme Court ruled incorrectly in 1973 that the Constitution protected a person's decision to terminate a pregnancy, as well as in the 1992 case that reaffirmed that right. Republicans said they believe it's more appropriate for legislatures to determine if pregnant people should be allowed to terminate a pregnancy or be required by the government to carry it to term. Catherine Glenn Foster, president and CEO of Americans United for Life, spoke about her decision to get an abortion when she was 19, though she said she doesn't think the ability to end a pregnancy should be legal going forward. Foster sought to rebut testimony from other witnesses that ending access to abortion or severely restricting it would disproportionately affect women of color. Quote, pro-life policies are meant to protect all human beings, Foster testified. Foster also compared people who support abortion rights to people who sought to keep slavery legal in the United States. Quote, "We once had allegedly serious citizens in America speak for slavery. Many fought and even died to perpetuate that injustice," Foster testified. "It seems incredible to us today, but Americans can and will overcome the injustices of abortion, just as Americans did finally overcome the injustice of slavery." Foster did not seem to support exceptions for rape or incest survivors and testified that the Supreme Court ending a nationwide fundamental right to an abortion would allow lawmakers to enshrine, quote, "law and policy that makes abortion unthinkable." Government and politics. Justice. Commentary. When will our, quote, pro-life, end quote, leaders do something about gun deaths? By Randy Evans, May 16, 2022. Aaron Salter Jr., 55, was on duty at the security job that supplemented his retirement income. Ruth Whitfield, 86, was buying groceries. Celestine Chaney, 65, stopped in for strawberries for the shortcake she and her sister were eager to enjoy. But their plans went awry Saturday afternoon. Salter's work shift ended sooner than he expected. Whitfield didn't make it through her grocery list, and thoughts of strawberry shortcake evaporated in a flash for Chaney. The three were slaughtered, along with seven other people, at a Tops supermarket in Buffalo, New York. Just like the 20 students, all 6 and 7 years old, and 6 employees who were massacred at Sandy Hook Elementary School in Connecticut in 2012. Just like the 60 people who were gunned down at a music festival in Las Vegas in 2017. If only our government officials were as interested in these individuals as were the political leaders who have obsessed over University of Pennsylvania swimmer Leah Thomas and her decision to compete for the Quakers, or NFL quarterback Colin Kaepernick and his decision to kneel during the national anthem. Of course, it is easier for politicians to talk about transgender athletes and to look for ways to score cheap political points. It takes time, and it opens a politician up to potential criticism to do the difficult work of finding ways to reduce gun violence. It is more difficult to muster the political courage to explore possible changes in laws that now allow anyone to assemble enough weaponry, body armor, and high-capacity ammo magazines to outfit an army platoon. While politicians solemnly offer their thoughts and prayers, these officials prefer to talk about the sanctity of the Second Amendment's, quote, right to bear arms, end quote, then explain how unfettered access to weapons of war squares with the, quote, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, end quote, promise our founding fathers laid out in the Declaration of Independence. Too few of our leaders seem to be giving much thought to how we are supposed to guard against tragedies like the one on Saturday, and the relentless carnage guns are causing across our nation. With public outrage boiling and the optics of the Buffalo tragedy so shocking, even some supporters of guns and people's rights to bear arms were keeping their, quote, thoughts and prayers, end quote, to themselves over the weekend, because, I am sure, they realized their statements rang hollow to many of us. The paralysis associated with our nation's response to gun violence is downright depressing. These senseless deaths are ruining families, leaving far too many people living in fear, and enraging so many. People are enraged because each time one of these tragedies occurs, too many of our leaders just appear to be marking time until journalists and the public turn their attention to another story. People are angry because too many leaders just shrug when they are asked why going to a grocery store has to be a life and death choice. These leaders are content to talk about the importance of better mental health services until the news crews get enough quotes and move on, and then our leaders return to their governing paralysis. People are incensed because, quote, pro-life, end quote, seems to have taken a backseat to pro-gun. The National Rifle Association and Second Amendment absolutists wrap themselves in the words, quote, right of the people to keep and bear arms, end quote, and skip over the other part about, quote, a well-regulated militia, end quote. The solution, in their view, is more guns. Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito has recently been in the news with his reminder about the importance of what is not said in the Constitution. Although he was writing about abortion, I am sure he would want to remind us, too, that there is no language in the Second Amendment that mentions unfettered access to high-capacity ammo magazines or weapons that can fire as rapidly as a shooter can pull the trigger. Yes, there is no magic solution that will end all mass killings. It is foolish to expect 100% perfection from every step that is proposed. And it is even more foolish to do nothing, knowing full well that within a week or two, the tragedy of another mass killing will visit another community after another deranged person decides to settle some perceived score by gunning down innocent people who are shopping for strawberries, sitting in a classroom, or enjoying a concert. How much longer must we wait before our, quote, leaders, end quote, actually lead on this problem? And that does it for today's reading of the Iowa Capital Dispatch for May 20th, 2022. I'm your reader, Stephen Gazier. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thanks for listening.